As indicated in your program, at this session we will hear a paper presented by L. Jackson Newell entitled Personal Conscience and Priesthood Authority, Perspectives on a Mormon Dilemma. Dr. Newell is Dean of the College of Liberal Education here at the University of Utah. He received his PhD in history from Ohio State. Following his paper, a response will be given by Dr. Stanley Kimball, teaching European history at Southern Illinois University. Dr. Kimball is the author of various books on early Mormon history, including one on Heber C. Kimball, another entitled Discovering Mormon Trails. I suppose he is our expert on the Mormon Trek West. He is here in Utah on sabbatical leave, working on a book called Westering Mormons, 1831-1869. We'd now like to follow the format that we did at the previous session here in the auditorium, which is to have the paper, the response, a brief counter-response, and then questions from the audience. Dr. Newell.
Thank you, Alan. As I go along, I think it will become evident that this topic is one of unusual interest and long-standing concern of my own, and that my analysis of the issue combines partially the detachment of the scholar and partially the involvement of the individual. From the teachings of its founder, Joseph Smith, down to the present time, Mormon doctrine has recognized two complementary, though sometimes competing, sources of authority in personal affairs. Through one source, the priesthood hierarchy, Latter-day Saints may receive guidance that pertains not only to them as individuals, but to other members as well. The other source, that of reason or inspiration, requires that we exercise personal initiative to seek truth and discover principles that may also elevate us towards Christian attitudes and behavior. These two foundations of religious belief and action are sometimes in conflict, and many Mormons are loath to trust the promptings of their conscience if it suggests a conclusion different from instructions received through priesthood channels. Church leaders increasingly stress the importance of obedience, thus diminishing the role of independent moral judgment, although our doctrine is peppered with warnings about the dangers of such an imbalance. At April conference in 1843, Joseph Smith defended Petaliah Brown, who was being tried by the High Council for heretical teaching, by declaring, "I do not like the old man being called up for erring in doctrine. He looks too much like the Methodists and not like the Latter-day Saints. The Methodists have creeds which a man must believe or be kicked out of their church. I want the liberty of thinking and believing as I please. It feels so good not to be trammeled. It does not prove that a man is not a good man because he errs in doctrine." It appears perhaps we've traded places, by the way, with the Methodists in the intervening century and a half. While Joseph warned of preoccupations with doctrinal conformity, Brigham Young counseled the saints regarding the dangers to individuals and to the church associated with blind followership. In the Tabernacle in 1862, Brigham said, "I am more afraid that this people have such confidence in their leaders that they will not inquire for themselves of God whether they are being led by Him. I am fearful they settle down in a state of blind self-security, trusting their eternal destiny to the hands of their leaders with a reckless confidence that in itself would thwart the purposes of God in their salvation and weaken that influence which they could give to their leaders. Did they know for themselves, by the revelations of Jesus, that they were led in the right way? Let every man and woman know, by the whisperings of the Spirit of God to themselves, whether their leaders are walking in the right path that the Lord dictates or not. This has been my exhortation continually," Brigham said. And only a decade ago, President David O. McKay's first counselor, Hubie Brown, was even more explicit about the need for a questioning faith. Addressing a spring convocation at BYU, Hubie Brown said, as he admonished the students, "You young people live in an age when freedom of the mind is suppressed over much of the world. We must preserve it in the church and in America, and resist all efforts of earnest men to suppress it. Preserve, then, the freedom of your mind in education and in religion, and be unafraid to express your thoughts and to insist upon your right to examine every proposition. We are not so concerned whether your thoughts are orthodox or heterodox as we are that you shall have thoughts." Each of these leaders and many others knew that while reasoned and reasonable obedience is essential to community, blind obedience is perilous to individuals and dangerous to society. It goes without saying, of course, that each of these leaders also spoke powerfully of the role of priesthood authority. Reconciling reason and faith is an age-old problem. Philosophers and laymen alike have anguished over it for millennia. But the issue is particularly poignant today in Mormon history because some church leaders are placing greatly increased emphasis on institutional loyalty and priesthood authority, as illustrated by Ezra Taft Benson's February 1980 speech at Brigham Young University. Using a military metaphor, he said, "Our marching orders for each 6 months are found in the General Conference addresses, which are printed in the Ensign magazine." Elder Benson went on to explain how one should handle conflicts that might arise between the words of our present leaders and those of earlier times. He said, "Beware of those who would pit dead prophets against living prophets, for living prophets always take precedence." End of quote. Conflicts between temporal knowledge and spiritual knowledge were also mentioned by Elder Benson. He said, "The prophet is not required to have any particular earthly training or credential to speak on any subject or act on any matter at any time." He ended with a grave warning. Quote, "The prophet and the presidency, follow them and be blessed, reject them and suffer." Though we may debate the practical application of these remarks, they do weigh heavily on the authoritarian side of the scale. Judgments of the institution and its leaders are to be accepted and followed by the individual. Two vital foundations of reasoning, knowledge from the past, and insight arising from personal experience, are called into question. On what basis, then, or with what confidence, might today's Latter-day Saint youth insist upon his right to question every proposition, as Hugh B. Brown so eloquently urged us to do just a decade ago? If there is truth in the notion that religion needs most and suffers most from institutionalization, then there may also be some value in considering a corollary. The individual needs most and suffers most from the church organization. This corollary could just as well be stated in reverse. The individual needs most and suffers most in his or her quest for personal identity. However we state the dilemma, the idea remains the same and the principle is hardly new. What is new only at the personal level. Each of us must reckon afresh with that basic conflict. As a social creature, I need ties and affiliations with others. And as an individual, I need freedom to express my unique aims and talents. Within Mormon culture, the dilemma is sharpened by explicit encouragements to encourage to group norms on the one hand and to multiply our talents and realize our unique personal potential on the other. Small wonder that many thoughtful Mormons struggle so valiantly to find peace with themselves and with their church. The quest to balance personal needs and beliefs with church loyalties has not always waged with success. Some surrender to the institution, whether from faith or exhaustion, and find contentment in the obedient life while memories of the encounter fade dimly from view. Others opt for freedom in personal expression and abandon ship, eventually dissolving their ties with organized religion in favor of less constraining social groups. But there are others who, for one reason or another, refuse to allow either social needs or personal ones to predominate. Within this group, too, a simplified view suggests two extremes: the unconscientious resistor, the foot dragger, and the conscientious critic, the loyal opposition. And I might say the autumn 1977 article "Passive Aggression and the Believer" by K. Lynn Paul is a considerable contribution to our understanding of the unconscientious resistor in the church. But the unconscientious resistor gives every appearance of conformity, but makes private accommodations of one kind or another. One example is the member who accepts a calling from a sense of duty and then proceeds in a half-hearted manner with the responsibilities. This approach is perilous to self-esteem, paralytic to community and institutional life. In the short run, however, it appears to be the route of least resistance, so its path is both well-known and frequently trodden. The other, the conscientious critic, pursues a healthier course, I believe. Conscientious critics give honest but appropriate expression of their personal views, seeking changes they believe would strengthen the church and the culture. But they remain committed to the institution and to the way of life. Conscientious critics walk a tightrope, however, because both their motives and their ideas are regarded with suspicion by Orthodox members and by foot draggers. What are some of the factors that make it possible for conscientious critics to exercise independent moral judgment and still enjoy institutional and cultural acceptance? It's my belief that Mormons have more freedom of expression and more latitude in behavior than most of us probably use. Local ward and stake attitudes and levels of tolerance do vary, but this statement seems to be true more often than not. A few members, however, make a show of their differences with the church or with Orthodox members of it simply to satisfy their own needs to be seen as independent-minded. Consciously or unconsciously, they may even seek to be ostracized. This behavior is regrettable, in my view, because it intimidates some who would otherwise enjoy greater freedom within the faith. Even so, others may hold the same ideas but express them without the intent of threatening or offending fellow members and get along just fine. But we're all well aware, however, that this is not always the case. Some critics may be quite artful at communicating without serious offense, but other factors, some quite unpredictable, also obtain. Some deviations of belief and practice are more threatening and less acceptable than others, and some ward, stakes, and missions are more tolerant than others. Regardless of these factors, there are limits beyond which no amount of artfulness will suffice. Where these outer limits are drawn in Mormon culture and in the Mormon church is a difficult judgment, as it is for any religious institution, and crossing them is painful for any thoughtful person. Those who have experienced the difficulty of drawing these lines and those who have felt the pain of crossing them are both represented among us here today, I hope. Foolish consistency, it has been said, is the hobgoblin of little minds. We needn't reconcile all that is currently known, both from reason and from revelation, into one consistent whole. As Edward Leaders expressed so effectively in the Clam Lake Papers, we should resist the temptation to reject a promising new idea simply because it appears to contradict an established notion or an existing truth. Perhaps a fuller understanding will someday reveal the unity we now fail to perceive. In the meantime, as the 13th Article of Faith suggests, let us embrace all that is of merit, without fretting over the compatibility of one idea with another. Why must our knowledge of geological antiquity cause us to deny God's role in the creation of the earth? Or why should evidence of evolutionary processes rule out our current or eventual likeness to the Creator? If we demand consistency, must we insist on it now at our present level of comprehension? While few would consciously deny that the purposes of religious activity are individual lives of integrity and service, in the LDS Church, we are especially prone to make strict judgments about what means, what personal regimens lead to these ends. Any large organization is tempted to standardize procedures at the expense of individual needs, and as a large institution, the Mormon Church is no exception. General authorities, correlation committee members, and others assume that a prescribed, highly structured set of activities will advance every member equally along a pathway to a life that is disciplined and humane. The list of expectations is now so staggering that few have the energy, time, or will to measure up completely, and many grapple with their conscience as a result. Worse still, we are all in danger of substituting performance of these many tangible duties for the development of a genuine Christian character, as we assess our worthiness before both man and maker. Is payment of 10% of our increase to the church a duty mindlessly performed, an organizational necessity, or an act of conscious caring that stimulates further generosity of both substance and spirit? If it is the latter, then a religious means has become an end in itself. If tithing becomes an end for me, and I am less generous and less caring with the 90% that remains, then the practice of tithing may actually become antithetical to its real purposes and to my development as a Christian human being. I'm not suggesting, incidentally, that we stop paying tithing, even if it has become a routine matter with us, because there are other reasons for doing it and others who benefit. But I do think each member should keep for himself or herself the responsibility to decide what practices and beliefs will produce the life of greatest integrity and service. Put differently, as an institution, the church appears to assume that a given set of means will produce similar ends for each of us. As individual members, however, we bear responsibility for our own progress. There is no substitute for introspection at regular intervals to sort out means and ends and measure our progress against the example of Christ. So long as our ends are truly His, we should not be timid about selecting from among or substituting for the institutionally prescribed means for advancing us toward that ideal. By placing so much responsibility with the individual, however, I am aware that my argument can easily be used to rationalize a variety of compromises with church doctrines and practices. There is a danger here, but acceptance of responsibility for one's own moral progress is the key, and maintenance of standards at least equal to those suggested by the church is essential to prevent abuse of the principle. Whether in the church or out, personal ambition requires sacrifice. One of the chief sacrifices made by those who aspire to leadership in the LDS Church, either consciously or unconsciously, is a degree of personal freedom. Because of the premium placed on obedience, orthodoxy in manner, dress, speech, and thought is often rewarded. One can advance an hypothesis, therefore, that the degree of freedom a member enjoys while remaining within the fold is inversely related to his or her need for status in the priesthood or organizational hierarchy. One who aspires to become a general authority or an auxiliary president, for example, has comparatively little latitude when compared with those who seek no more than to contribute to religious community life within their own ward through teaching a Sunday school class or working with the youth. In 1980 terms, this means that the latter has the option to support the Equal Rights Amendment while the former does not. A constraint related to ambition is employment. Those who seek or hold employment with the church must accept the fact that they will be judged more strictly, other things being equal, than other members. No coke is sold in the church office building. No beards are worn at BYU. Unless Scott Kinney or I or some of the others here are invited down for conference for the day. Conscientious critics need support and association with others of like mind, not so much to bolster their strength as to nourish their commitment to the church. While that statement may have the ring of paradox, it sets forth a principle that I have experienced and observed. As a young college professor in the mission field some 15 years ago, dialogue saved my faith. I needed to know that other Latter-day Saints had the same frustrations and experienced the same intellectual dilemmas as I. For example, one frequent source of frustration and confusion among members is haggling over fine points of doctrine. If a woman is widowed with several children after being married in the temple and later marries a widower, and they have children, who will the children of this new union belong to in the hereafter? Such questions may be good teasers to forestall senility, but to me they always have an unreal ring. Do we know enough about the hereafter to reach our grim conclusions? And can't a loving, omnipotent God somehow find a solution more satisfying than our fledgling attempts? My preference is the trust in God to provide appropriate reward for those who, despite seeming historical or theological quirks, competently and gracefully handle that which falls within their realm of influence. Coming back to dialogue, I needed to see that others could wrestle with the same doubts that I had and remain committed. Reading Dialogue Under Trees Bedecked with Spanish Moss in South Carolina, I observed through the vicarious example of others that being half sure didn't have to mean being half-hearted. Responsible critics are encouraged in both their responsibility and their faith by contact with others. Sunstone, Dialogue, Exponent 2, and similar publications play an important role here, as do study groups of thoughtful and open-minded members, and symposia like the one we're all participating here in this week. Another function of these periodicals and friendships and networks is to provide healthy, constructive avenues for the expression of ideas arising from personal frustrations with the church organization and with Mormon culture. It is preferable to ventilate than to suppress anger, and it is better, far better, to propose solutions and seek alternatives than to lash out with bitter criticism. E.E. Cummings is supposed to have said that most people can be put in one of two categories: those who define themselves primarily by what they're against, and those who define themselves primarily by what they are for. Well-educated people, thinking people, often fall into the first group, and they make good critics because they have been schooled, as most of us have, in analytical methods. But they are too seldom constructive critics, and when they are not, they are notoriously ineffective in the church. Those who genuinely seek the space to be intellectually honest in the church will have a wider berth if they are the second, more positive type. My conclusions are both theological and personal. My thesis is that Mormon doctrine includes both a Catholic and a Quaker strain. We share with Catholics a hierarchical belief in a divinely guided priesthood organization with authority passed down from a leader who is commissioned by the Lord himself. And we share with the Quakers a democratic belief that the Lord may speak directly with each of us, and that our salvation depends on our personal relationship with deity, not on human intermediaries. Much of the strength and beauty of LDS theology arises from the creative tension provided by the juxtaposition of these two concepts, concepts that are considered mutually exclusive by most of the Christian world. I believe priesthood authority and personal inspiration are necessary countervailing forces. One assures the survival of the church, and the other affixes responsibility for moral action and for salvation upon the individual. The church is properly concerned with doctrine, but each of us will ultimately be judged, in my opinion, by what we do. Our deeds will tell the tale. As a convert to the church, I was attracted by the compelling power of these two gracefully balanced assumptions, priesthood authority and personal revelation. And now, as a member of nearly two decades, I am troubled because of the balance appearing to be threatened. Fortunately, our doctrine and our history both speak directly to this issue. But a cattleman from Dixie may have said it as well as any, cautioning her about a tendency to question. Juanita Brooks' father philosophized, "My girl, if you will follow this tendency to criticize, I'm afraid you will talk yourself right out of the church. I'd hate to see you do that. I'm a cowboy, and I've learned that if I ride the herd in the herd, I'm lost, totally helpless. One who rides counter to it is trampled and killed. One who only trails behind means little because he leaves all responsibility to others. It's the cowboy who rides the edge of the herd, who sings and calls and makes himself heard, who helps direct the course. Happy sounds are generally better than cursing, but there are times when one must maybe swear a little and swing a whip or a lariat to round in a stray or turn a leader. So don't lose yourself and don't ride away and desert the outfit. Ride the edge of the herd and be alert. But know your directions and call out loud and clear. The chances are you won't make a difference, but then again, you just might." Fixing our eyes on truly Christian objectives and committing ourselves and our energies to things that we can humanely influence, may we reaffirm within the LDS Church and beyond each other's right to independent moral judgment based on personal inspiration. Thank you.
I'd like to start the first part of my response off in a most unscholarly way. First, I'm not going to give a paper of my own. Second, I'm not going to criticize the paper Professor Newell did not write. I'm even going to try and leave time for questions and answers. But the most unscholarly thing I'm going to do is to tell him how much I really liked and enjoyed his paper. So much, in fact, that I'm going to right now pay Professor Newell the highest encomium it is possible for anyone who was buried alive the first 14 years of their life in Farmington, Utah, to pay anyone. And that is, you just done grand. Or its variant, you done good. Anyway, we need more, much more, such responsible and courageous analysis of the anomalies and the contradictions in our faith, or at least in what we perceive to be the inspired utterances of our leaders. We need to think more deeply to work out our own salvation, and best of all, I love this phrase, to be anxiously engaged in a good cause. And certainly, serious reflection is a good cause. But we as a people are generally very weak in reflection and contemplation. We're hardly encouraged in it to do it very much. It is far, far easier, as Professor Newell has pointed out, to follow unquestioningly, even blindly. This reminds me of the terrible oversimplifications of the evangelists. I once heard Billy Graham about 25 some odd years ago in the old Madison Square Gardens, and he just had the answer to everything. It was just so terribly simple. I was frightened to death with it. One other reason that I like this paper so much is that Dean Newell has spelled out, categorized, and defined where I personally stand in the hierarchy of orthodoxy. I've often referred to myself for years as a member of the loyal opposition and frequently wondered how many others there were. But I've never seen this particular category of Mormons set out so clearly vis-a-vis other related categories. In Professor Newell's pecking order, I am a 3B, a conscientious critique, a member of the loyal opposition. And I might add, perfectly content to be one and to remain one. As a 3B, however, I have been lucky to have kept my job for 18 years on the St. Louis State High Council. Actually, they don't know what else to do with me. I'm never in uniform, as I am certainly not today. For years, I've worn nothing but white ties and dark shirts. My hair's too long, and I wear sideburns. And Violet and I also not only subscribe to Dialogue, Sunstone, and Exponent 2, as well as practically everything cranked out by modern microfilm, but we even read it. I suspect I've served under three stake presidents simply because I furnish a little comic relief. And now, in the spirit of one great leader of mankind, I would like to challenge this assembly like this. Three B's of Mormonism arise. You have nothing to lose but your frustrations. And perhaps, or obviously, we have much to offer in not only building but bettering the kingdom and reaching the Nicodemuses that are out there, the sophisticated investigators. I really believe they have souls too, and I think it is our special category, our special calling, to somehow reach those people and get through the fuddy-duddy-ism and let them see what I love to call the majesty of Mormonism. I've long had in mind a volume, and I'm going to suggest that Sunstone sponsor it. It should be an edited volume, and I'd be happy to participate. But I think it's about time we all got together and wrote a book entitled Prometheus Hobbled, The Intellectual in Mormondom. Now, let me try to be a little more serious. Dr. Newell's paper is more of an enlightened and perceptive theological essay than a scholarly treatise. And here I am, a historian trained in the German methods of criticism and no theologian at all. In fact, I've always maintained there wasn't enough formal theology in Mormonism to bother with, an opinion I think I'm about to lose, incidentally. Since Professor Newell's paper is an essay, his major premise, thesis, and argument is built on a rather narrow basis. I count but four quotations from President Smith, Young, Brown, and Benson. Juxtaposing these four statements, Dean Newell demonstrates conflict and tension. Conflict and tension, yes, plenty of it. And I'm thoroughly convinced his basic premise is correct. But the limits of time have forced him to oversimplify the evolution and the progress of this tension. The progression is not as a crescendo of ever-increasing conservatism and authoritarianism. I see it more like the high and low points of a graph, tending upwards towards, or maybe down, but anyway, tending towards conservatism and authoritarianism, but with many retreats from this position. For example, what Brigham Young said about personal inspiration could be countered by the extreme authoritarianism in this matter of my illustrious grandsire, Heber C. Kimball. Davis Bitton wrote a whole paper on the authoritarian imagery in Heber C. Kimball's sermons. What Ezra Taft Benson said in February of 1980 could be countered with what Dean Larson of the First Quorum of 70 said in the May 1980 Ensign. And I quote, "Programmed behavior cannot produce the level of spiritual development required to qualify one for eternal life. A necessary range of freedom is essential." Close quotes. I wonder if when Dean Newell reworks this excellent essay for publication in Sunstone, of course, that he might plug in the favorite concept of many Mormons that their leaders receive inspiration for the church as a whole, while individuals may receive it for themselves and their own personal affairs. On the question of reason versus faith, which this paper briefly mentions, I've always felt that the Thomistic synthesis, that certain things are best learned by faith and other things are best learned by reason, is peculiarly helpful to us caught in this dilemma. This whole question of following or not following dead prophets is troublesome. Which dead prophets should we not follow? I would guess that 90% of the time, this reference is made to Brigham Young. Who lived in a glorious day of theological speculation and who held categorical opinions on virtually everything. It is a truism, of course, that Brigham Young couldn't get into the Y today and wouldn't make much of a missionary in today's church. Maybe 5% of the time we are warned about something relative to Joseph Smith. And maybe the other 5% is in reference to John Taylor and polygamy. But who else? Well, I have no fear of being led astray by Presidents Young, Smith, and Taylor. But I do wish we did not follow that particular dead prophet who trivialized the majesty of Mormonism by changing the word of wisdom from a principle of temperance into an iron law of abstinence, and for making this relative trifle in our theology the touchstone of orthodoxy, the ultimate group moray which binds us together as and makes us a peculiar people. I had the great experience once out in the wilds of Davis County of hearing a little old lady voice an opinion on this topic of peculiarities. And she said, yes, Stanley, we are a peculiar people, but let's not be too damn peculiar. To me, the best part of this excellent essay is the section on how thoughtful Latter-day Saints wrestle and try to find peace with themselves and with the church, and with the strong admonition for those of us inclined as 3Bs to criticize, that we should be positive in our and constructive in our criticism and not merely and cheaply and easily negative. One of the three stake presidents under whom I served once said in a high council meeting, I can find 20 people in this stake to tell me exactly what's wrong with everything. He said, I'm not interested in that. I want to find one that can give me some constructive advice as what to do about it. On page 6, Dean Newell points out so well the great, really great danger of substituting performance of these many tangible duties for the development of a genuinely Christian character. It seems that I hear behind this the words of the Savior and Paul, for the letter killeth, but the Spirit giveth life. And now in conclusion, lest my patron saint, Leopold von Ranke, is up there, let me say that in essence, Professor Newell's essay is weak in heuristic, but excellent in critique, Auffassung and Darstellung, and 3 out of 4 is not bad. Thank you.
Sunstone's general approach to the potential problem of dealing with what might be a controversial issue is to provide balance, and I'm not sure that we have been able to do that in finding a respondent that so wholeheartedly agrees with the main speaker. However, we have a whole room of individuals here that can provide that balance if it's necessary, and we would now like to open the floor to questions, and you may address your question to either or both of our speakers.
First of all, I'd like to say as an Ohio farm boy and responding to the remarks of the Utah farm boy, aw shucks. Responding to your question, it seems to me, Stanley makes an excellent addendum to my remarks, and that is that we are not seeing a steady movement in Mormon history in one direction, but we have seen, in fact, cycles that have risen and fallen in the acceptability of genuine yeasty debate about some of the critical issues that face us as a church and as individuals. And the existence of B.H. Roberts in the church was a high point. Hubie Brown's eloquent statement of some of the concerns that we have here was another. And it seems to me, in one real sense, it is people who simply care about these issues, like us, and it makes no difference, it seems to me, whether we're general authorities or simply committed members, that really keep this kind of spirit alive. And I don't think that we should necessarily seek institutional endorsement. I don't know. It seems to me it would be helpful. I would enjoy the involvement of general authorities in a discussion of the type that we're having here during these 2 days and in this particular session. On the other hand, it seems to me that that to ask for acceptance, to engage in the kind of questioning and the examination of every proposition, as Hubie Brown put it, is in a sense to beg the question. It seems to me we have that right. Our history and our doctrine makes that clear. And I think we should simply be eager and courageous and responsible in pursuing the kind of ideas and exchanging the kind of ideas that we've all come here to do. Thanks.
May I just add a footnote to that? We've been talking about a progression, and I think your question leads into this. There was a time when the pioneer plowman reigned supreme, and then when the desert was tamed and all of that, we moved off into the businessman administrator, and there we've stayed. However, there are little green shoots here and there and around and about that someday the artist scholar will come into their own along with. We'll never get rid of the, and we shouldn't get rid of the businessman administrator, but we certainly do need the artist scholar up there with them, and I suspect we're going to have to carve out that niche ourselves. And if we do it as suggested, constructively, we hopefully will make it. And if we remain, as the Lord has commissioned us, anxiously engaged in a good cause, which can cover a multitude of sins, but incidentally, it's a marvelous excuse when you're questioned on what in the world it is you're trying to do, I think we can affect this continuum and increasingly bring the artist scholar into a position to be more important. Well, my illustrious grandsire once voiced an opinion on this, and he said in 1860, forget exactly, but he said the bishop today, the average Mormon bishop today, has more control over the people than Joseph Smith had in his day. So I suppose that Joseph had his problems, but I think his philosophy was, I teach the right principles and let them govern themselves, which suggests he wasn't always busy noticing every little thing and worrying about it and devising programs to do something about it. And then secondly, your question raises the specter of plain ordinary bigness and that awful word bureaucracy, which we are getting caught up with more all the time, and there indeed is a real critical issue. How are we going to get increasingly bigger and avoid the dead weight of bureaucracy? And my answer is, I don't know.
I think much of the... pardon? Okay, I'll try. That's a good idea. I should try and paraphrase it myself. I think the question is the tendency toward conformity in the church based on a kind of terror that we will jeopardize our chance to receive celestial glory if we differ or disobey or disagree? Or does it come and spring more directly from a positive desire on our part to understand and to serve? Does that get at the question? I think I'd respond in a couple of ways to that. One of them is that I think in any institution there is probably a fair combination of fear, which stimulates conformity, as well as positive affiliation. And I suppose part of the issue that we're all grappling with here today in this particular session is, are we doing things for the right reason? Are we paying tithing, to use the example of the paper, because we're afraid not to? Or is there something about understanding the principle which helps us to become more generous in our attitudes toward other people? And I suppose this is at the heart, theologically at the heart, of each of our efforts to sort out and decide why we are Latter-day Saints, why we are doing the things we do, and progressing in that manner. The other response is that I think there is an awful lot in the church which arises from social pressure, which is really unconnected with directions that arise from the priesthood at the top of the apex, that is, from the First Presidency, the Quorum of the Twelve. There are lots of things, I think, which we associate with Mormon culture, which are not, in fact, a part of Mormon theology, but there still remains a premium on doing those things simply because they've been accepted by other members. This, I think, is an area in which we'll probably have increasing latitude for the reason that many of these cultural norms of Mormonism really have been American norms. And as the church becomes less and less an American church and more a worldwide church, obviously many of these American norms are simply inappropriate. And I think it's stimulating our understanding and our ability to sort out that which is genuinely associated with the gospel and the revealed and restored church, and that which has simply come along with it and we've accumulated and carried as baggage which we've associated with the church but really may not be, in fact. Now I've got a third point, if I can just take a minute to say that. And that is that I think that if we were to look at the church hierarchy, I hate to overuse that word, but the church organization from the top through the middle management and down to the grassroots, that is, from the First Presidency and the Quorum of the Twelve, through the church organization, missions, stake presidencies, and so forth, and down to the ward bishop, it seems to me that the greatest pressure for conformity and the conservative, if we might call it that, interpretation of our doctrine tends to come at the middle management level. It is, I think, often, if we really examine what President Kimball is saying and the others are saying, it is surprisingly understanding of our need to arrive at our own conclusions and to hammer out our own faith. And it seems to me ward bishops, where they're dealing on the line day to day with the problems of individuals in those wards, generally they are very understanding, and they are not constrictive in their interpretation of Mormon doctrine and Mormon theology in its application to the members of their wards. But it seems to me often it's at the middle management level, stake presidents, mission presidents, regional representatives, and so forth, where, in a sense, there is such a premium on almost going one better than what instructions have been given to them in order to prove their valiance, that we get the more conservative interpretation, which often, I think, provides the frustrations, at least, which I often seem to feel. So it seems to me it's the middle level, not the top or the ward bishop level, where we more often get the more conservative as opposed to the more humane spirit of the law kind of interpretation.
I'll attempt one tiny piece of an answer to that in reference to cultural excellency. That's not exactly your question, but it's the only one I'm prepared to give at the moment. And it relates to a lot of other things that have been said this morning. You will remember that when the current prophet, Spencer W. Kimball, was an apostle, some years ago, he gave what I thought was a marvelous clarion call to cultural excellence. And he talked about Mormon Michelangelos and Mormon Beethovens and one thing and another. And not much happened. I think BYU Fine Arts Week or something grew out of that, which was a good first step. And then you will recall that later, as president, this speech was excerpted in the Ensign about 2 years ago and kind of died away. And you will notice that when we're called to clean up, paint up, or don't kill the little birds, or put in a 2-year supply and plant a garden, all of the easy things the saints grab and run with them because they are easy. But a call for cultural excellence is hard, and then it gets caught up in the bureaucracy, and then what do we end up with? In the two primary foci of LDS culture on Temple Square, well, not and on Temple Square in the visitor center and in the church office building, we get that huge candy box cover, short-haired Nordic Christ, commissioning the 12 apostles to go, which at best is an illustration. It's Mormon socialism. And across the street, we have a copy of a magnificent statue, but not an original. So I'm really not answering your question directly because I'm not sure of the answer, but I do see that here is a problem of wrestling with bigger ideas and how to handle them, even when challenged by the prophet himself to handle them. And therefore, this gets back to us three B's. I think we have got to come up with a positive, constructive way to blast through bureaucracy.
In the front here.
I think you were asking who said power corrupts, absolute power corrupts, absolutely. That's Lord Acton about the 18th century, Great Britain. And I guess that prompts the observation that it seems to me this is a problem not simply for Mormon culture, but it's a problem for any culture in which you have authority and priesthood combined. It becomes particularly difficult for people to hammer out their own identity when it is not simply the temporal authority which is involved, but also the individual's serious, legitimate concern about their own eternal welfare. And it seems to me this really punctuates the dilemma that we're facing today. Is it legitimate for me, it seems to me, many Mormons ask, to raise questions which may in fact jeopardize my opportunities for a celestial future? And it seems to me what I have attempted to do, at least in this paper, is to say that our history and our doctrine adequately provides a substance and spirit which says to us, yes, question, you must find out for yourself. Your question, what is the ultimate end? What are we after? It seems to me what we are after is a religious culture in which people grow to their fullest potential and in which that growth incorporates a legitimate, vital concern for the welfare of other people. It seems to me that's what Christ taught, is this church is committed to teach us and to lead us in the directions of his example. That's what we're after. Humane lives of service, of integrity, and personal growth.
We're nearing the end of our time. We have many questions, and let me just say that this evening at Dr. Newell's home, we will be having a kind of a reception, open house type of an event to which you are invited, and we hope that you will take the opportunity of asking your questions of those participants in our symposium. I'll entertain one more question from the gentleman in the back, far back with the glasses and the beard. Would you like to, you are the one.